Hey, I'm Jane Lindholm. I'm the host of Vermont Edition, and I'm just popping in to tell you that this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. It's a scourge that continues to break families' hearts and ruin addicts' lives. Opioid addiction continues to be a major battle in this state and around the country. Vermont has been trying to take active steps to deal with opioid abuse and to prevent new cases of addiction, creating a law that limits prescriptions of opioids, asking health insurance companies, doctors, and patients themselves to educate themselves and think hard about their expectations and needs around pain, and working to cut down on the barriers to treatment for people who realize they need help. But it can be difficult to ascertain if those efforts are stemming the tide and to have a comprehensive view of what more needs to be done. Figuring that out has been part of Jolinda LeClaire's job. She's the director of drug prevention policy for Vermont, and she oversees the state's Opioid Coordination Council. The council has finally released a report looking at what's working and proposing a strategy for targeted efforts moving into the future. She joins us today to go over some of what she's learned. Jolinda, welcome back to the program.
Thanks very much, Jane. It's a pleasure to be here.
Also with us today to talk about opioid addiction and prevention is Vermont's Health Commissioner, Dr. Mark Levine. Nice to have you back on the program.
Thank you, Jane.
So the stats are grim. I mean, let's just tick a few of them off. There were more than 100 deaths attributed to opioid overdoses in Vermont in 2016. Early statistics suggested that 2017 was on target to have a similar number, perhaps slightly lower. More than half of the kids under the age of 5 in DCF custody are there because of opioid abuse issues. And nationally, drug overdoses now kill more people than gun homicides and car crashes combined. And yet, both of you believe that there is some room for optimism right now. Jolinda, why?
I think while the stats may be grim, the partnerships are strong, and that's why. When we look across the four drivers of Vermont's response to our challenges with opioids or substance use disorders in general, prevention, treatment, recovery, and enforcement, we have this incredible cadre of leaders and professionals from hospitals to the community door, people in recovery, families and loved ones of people in recovery, and all have expressed and are acting upon a desire to work together to effect change.
So the partnerships are in place, and does it just take a little while to see results in terms of people who are able to access treatment and stay clean? Or, I mean, partnerships are great, but not if they don't actually do what we're hoping to do.
So when you think about any systems and systemic change, we are always talking years and years and years in the workings, whether it's the environment, it's agriculture, it's community and economic development. Having a lot of experience in the public sector over 30 years, I've watched collaborations take root and change happens over time. It is never overnight.
Dr. Levine, you share Jolinda LeClaire's optimism?
Absolutely. I'm fond of saying that we're in this as a marathon, not as a sprint. And we know that we still have an average of 2 Vermonters dying per week of an unintentional overdose. We have perhaps as many as 8 out of 10 Vermonters with substance use disorder who aren't actively seeking treatment. And our communities continue to experience distress. Everyone knows somebody who's been afflicted. But at the same time, we've made great progress, and we need to acknowledge that even though we can't let up and we have to embark on numerous initiatives. We're still a state leader nationally when you look at us against the rest of the country with our medication-assisted treatment programs, the health home model that we've adapted to that called the hub and spoke, which is really treating opioid use disorder as a chronic disease. We have capacity now with no waiting lists for anyone who is seeking treatment to have access to treatment. We have a very strong history of partnership with Medicaid, and we have lots of active strategies in harm reduction with the naloxone programs, syringe exchange, safe disposal, et cetera. And in prevention, we've got new prescriber rules that we're beginning to see some traction from. We have a Vermont prescription monitoring system, which has been effective. We have some very strong messaging programs that target specific audiences by the specific media that they use. We have some school-based programming going on, and community coalitions are arising throughout the state because people really want to take personal responsibility for helping their community try to manage this. And we have a set of strong recovery centers. So that's really good news, but at the same time, we know that this is a very long battle to fight, and we have a lot more work to do.
We got a note from Sue who says, "When I learned of my daughter's heroin use, it changed my life and that of all family members. At the time, my daughter was a mom of two young children herself. My daughter's young son and daughter were the ones who were most affected by their mother's behavior. They came to live with me and remained in my care until they graduated from high school. Even now, as young adults, the impact of addiction remains a source of sadness in their lives. I learned about Nar-Anon Family Groups, a 12-step program for families and friends of addicts, and I brought a chapter to Brattleboro nearly 20 years ago, and the group still meets today. Though the need for support is great, very few people make the commitment to attend. This is disheartening because there's much to learn about addiction and how to respond to it." Sue, I appreciate you sharing your thoughts. And again, listeners, if you'd like to weigh in, tell us what you see working, what you would like to see more focus on from the state. Our number again, 1-800-639-2211. Jolinda, Dr. Levine talked about a lot of areas where the state is working hard and coalitions of people are working hard. What else would you point to, broadly speaking, that you think we're doing well?
Well, I'd like to take up with the point that you just made. About 6 months ago, parents came up to me after A Hungry Heart was aired at the studios at Vermont Public Television right down the road from here.
And that's Bess O'Brien's documentary film about young people who are addicted to opioids and a particular doctor who has helped get them treatment.
Dr. Fred Holmes, who was out of St. Albans and spent his life helping people with addiction. The parents who came up to us asked us where they could access support services. And so we started digging. 211 is a wonderful resource, and we want to make sure we call that out always, because whether you are a person with addiction or you family and loved ones with addiction, with living with someone who has addiction in your household or in your family, you want to be able to access supports when you feel like you are ready. There are many, they're all recovery centers. As Commissioner Levine noted, there are 12 around the state. Most have programs for families and loved ones who are looking for supportive services. There are not easy to access points across the state. So we want to be able to go right into a database and say, okay, if I live in Jericho, Vermont, not necessarily in Burlington, or I live in the outskirts of Bennington County, not right in downtown Bennington, where can I call somebody as well as go to a community support group?
I stop you there and add in a comment that we got from Dennis in Burlington, who wants to ask, what about the lack of inpatient treatment facilities in northern Vermont?
Mm-hmm. I'm going to hand that one over to Commissioner Levine.
Yes, we have apparently enough capacity in the existing residential treatment centers to manage the Vermonters who need to have that avenue of care. I should add that it's very challenging to determine who should get what level of care at the onset of their access to treatment. But there's a rather elaborate intake process that incorporates a whole host of factors, including their substances use, the current substance use, their past history, their medical and mental health histories, their current status in terms of family support, employment, housing, stability. And all of those things are integrated together to help determine what is best for an individual. We have found that using such a system, we can direct appropriate people to residential treatment or to the hubs, which require which are where you may obtain methadone if you're at that level of care, or buprenorphine, or the spokes, where you can only use buprenorphine. Those are more primary care practices. And all of these have very well integrated comprehensive services, including mental health, counseling, care management services, etc. So the bottom line is some of our residential facilities actually have contracts with some of the adjoining states because they're not being maximally utilized all of the time.
So to Dennis's question about, I think it was specific to geography and northern Vermont being a space that felt lacking, it's less about geographical proximity for the inpatient treatment facilities.
Right, and more about what is the capacity we need throughout the state. I would add that there are individuals who also access treatment facilities outside of state.
Angela, and I interrupted you.
No, that's fine. We must always remember Vermont is really small. We have 630,000 people statewide. I mean, we are like a
and
big,
you're rounding up.
We're like a big and I'm rounding up. We're like a big county. We do well in terms of our program delivery across the state. I mean, for all intents and purposes, we have 12 regions of the state, and we have a delivery system that's outstanding. You can access services locally, regionally, as well as statewide. So I think it's really important to note this hub and spoke system for treatment, you reach people in every single county across the state.
Let's go to Jasdeep, who's calling in from Burlington. Hi, Jasdeep. Go right ahead.
Yeah. Hi. So I'm curious to know, any of the groups studied how Portugal has handled their problem, and also how much money is being allotted towards education as opposed to enforcement and rehabilitation, which, you know, scientifically we've shown is not really the best approach. It's really through education as we did with tobacco.
Thanks for the call. Jolinda?
Great point, and we agree. We spent quite a bit of time talking about best practices across the country as well as across the world, and it's something we need to do a lot more in terms of studying. What we know is that prevention programs, both school-based and community-based, which need to ultimately be integrated, they are effective. What we also know is we need to do better understanding which of these evidence-based best practices are most effective, and how do you coordinate the work regionally. Vermont is an incredibly rural state. Ironically, as I talk about how few people we have, we are the second most rural state in the nation based on the U.S. Census definition of rural. And so how do we make sure the people in Essex County, which only has about 6,000 people in a very large geographic landmass, have access to transportation and childcare and housing and the employment supports that they need in order to reenter society if you are an offender coming out of a correctional facility or you are a person who is coming out of inpatient treatment or you are accessing on a daily basis outpatient treatment services?
I want to stick with this question of education and how to talk to people about this for a few moments because there are several different points, and one of them is educating doctors and prescribers. But, you know, this it's a different message when you talk about school-based education on opioids than it would be for even cigarettes. I mean, the message that seems to be working and seems to have worked for young people on smoking is just don't do it. Don't ever do it. Don't start. It's bad for you. It's different when we're talking about something that a doctor prescribes for you, and that's complicated because there are times when your doctor will still tell you, you need to take this medication. And so nobody's saying that opioids should not be in the toolbox of doctors ever to use. So how do you do that education piece? And, you know, just for me, I remember I had a cesarean section and I said, don't give me the opiates. And my OBGYN said, don't be stupid. You need them. So, you know, there's that question of all in one direction or all in the other. How do you educate people?
That's a great question, Jane. And one of the big emphases that we've had at the health department specifically in this education effort is acknowledging that it is that acute opioid prescribing that has probably in the past gotten out of control, where the dosage was too large, the duration of treatment was too long, and the expectation was that the total number of pills prescribed would be needed in their entirety. We've learned just from studying the problem, both here and at Dartmouth, that patients use far less of the prescriptions they received than we would have imagined, and probably about 28% of the medication is all that was needed, and numerous individuals never filled their prescriptions. So I think you're right that educating prescribers and educating patients about the realistic expectations and what is needed. And when you had your cesarean section, you probably were grateful to have medication for the first 24 to 48 hours, and it could be rapidly tapered down, and you could go home on nothing like that, just over-the-counter medication. And that's the realization we've come to as a medical community that's going to be very helpful in the future.
So it sounds like on the education piece, some of it is around addiction and around addiction science and around not, you know, diverting medication, but some of it is also education culturally around pain management.
And it's prescriber education and patient education. So you and I as lay people can speak about patient education, which you just did. I just had my most recent experience because I'm going in for a little minor knee surgery, and the doctor immediately talked to me about the pain meds that were my options. And I think that's what is really different in 2018. And it began even before the new prescriber rules went into effect July 1 of 2017, is that you may opt just for a greater dose of Tylenol. And we all need to know that.
I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Jolinda LeClaire is Director of Drug Prevention Policy for Vermont, where she oversees the state's Opioid Coordination Council. Mark Levine is Vermont's Health Commissioner. They're with us today looking at what the council has found that's working and where there's still a need for improvement. Feels like we talk about opioid addiction all the time, but it's incremental. So you've got to keep an eye on what's working, what's not working, tweak around the margins, and in some cases make wholesale changes. So we're looking at all of that today. We got a note from Patricia, who says, my youngest son is 28 and he struggled with an oxy addiction since 2011. Within 2 years, we did our first intervention. He relapsed and within another year lost his business and was arrested. Patricia goes on to tell us that he was in and out of rehab and jail, and she became frustrated in her experiences with various caseworkers and probation officers. She says her son eventually started getting the Suboxone medically assisted treatment as well as a prescription for antidepressants, but that he was arrested again late last year, and she says he did not get his Suboxone or other medications in jail. And she continues, quote, for me, the biggest concern was that my son would relapse when released from jail. People should not be released from a correctional facility and face relapse because DOC has pulled them off their medically assisted treatment. Dr. Levine, do you care to comment on that?
Sure. We have a number of initiatives going on with DOC, and I want your listeners to understand that Vermont is in the top 3 or 4 states when it comes to concerns about individuals who are in the Department of Corrections and have substance use disorder. We currently have programs within DOC where individuals who have been on buprenorphine can continue to get that immediately when they enter the facility. And we're trying to make sure that they can get it for as long as we think they might need it, specifically longer than 90 days. We also have programs where...
Why then? Was there a problem with getting them to be able to have that continuum?
It was not a problem. It was just that it was set at a 90-day limit. And you have to understand the flux in corrections is so great, people are coming in and leaving all the time. The other thing that we have to make sure of is that they are very quickly connected with a hub or spoke at the time that they leave corrections so that there'll be very little time elapsed between leaving and getting their appropriate medications. Finally, for those who have not been on any medication-assisted treatment and leave the Department of Corrections but have a known substance use disorder, they're provided with an injection of naltrexone, Vivitrol, which can help them till they can seek access to care when they get out. So we're very, very concerned about making sure that those in corrections have appropriate care. And there is such a large percentage of those entering corrections who have either a mental illness or a substance use disorder that continuing their medications is really critical. Listeners have to recognize that individuals lose their Medicaid when they enter corrections, so that the state ends up picking up the tab for that. And it's why most of the other states are not actually doing anything in corrections and why the National Commission raised that as an important issue for the president.
You mean in most other states, people who are on Suboxone are not getting it in prison?
They may not. I won't say they are not, but they may not, depending on the policies of that state.
John is calling in from Bethel. Hi, John. Go right ahead. You're on the air. Hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm a retired respiratory therapist. I've dealt with smokers for many, many years, and it's like a 90% failure rate. And what do you do about people on heroin that just can't get off it? Why do we make them criminals? We made a whole generation criminals. And why don't we do like Europe does, put them on the drug that's making them happy and try to wean them off while they don't go out robbing and stealing and screwing up their families in the process?
John, let me ask you, do you think that that's not happening? I mean, that's part of what we were just talking about, for example, with drugs, maintenance drugs like Suboxone to address an addiction to opioids. Are you seeing that not happen around the state?
I've dealt with a lot of heroin addicts, find that they're always, they'll take it for a while, they'll go back onto the heroin, and they go back on it, they go back on it, they go back on it. Cigarette smokers aren't punished and made criminals, and what they do is pretty bad. And why do we criminalize the people who need the heroin because they want to be happy?
John, thanks for the call. Let me give this to Jolinda LeClaire, because John's touching on a number of issues there, and it's interesting to tease some of them apart.
Yeah. So I thank you for your questions. I think you're talking about access to treatment. You're also talking about criminal justice reform. We in the state of Vermont are working really hard, and I would say this is not only treatment providers but law enforcement, to meet people where they are and get as many people into treatment as possible. We use syringe exchange programs. We use connection with intervention and referral to treatment in emergency departments in order to increase the number of people we have in treatment. I'm just going to note, because there are a few statistics we can throw out here, there are approximately 7,000 people here in Vermont who are in treatment. We estimate that there are approximately 20,000 people who live with substance use disorder who are, so that means about two-thirds not in treatment, and we are constantly trying to figure out how do we encourage and, again, meet people where they are so they will end up in treatment. There are many efforts right now to look at criminal justice reform, to enhance drug treatment courts, and to enhance diversion opportunities. So I think all of those go to support your questions.
Can I ask you, both of you, I'd love to get a response, because I don't think there's an official response, but we've talked on this program before, and there's been some talk around the state about safe injection sites. Mm-hmm. And when you talk about things like syringe exchanges, that's not mentioned. Do you take a position? Does the Opioid Council take a position on safe injection sites?
We did not take a position on that. The Commissioner of Public Safety, Tom Anderson, recently testified in the Senate Judiciary Committee, where they have a bill that they are looking at. And what the Opioid Coordination Council has done is said that we would consider this issue in the coming year, and we would report back to the Senate by the fall of next year.
And Dr. Levine?
Exactly.
For the Health Department?
The Health Department is actually performing much of the study that will be required to help us have that position. We do feel that we do have a number of other resources, though, like the needle exchange and syringe exchange programs, the naloxone programs, that are clearly helping people stay alive and protecting them in some way. And perhaps expansion of those would be a less expensive mode of intervention. If I could give two further answers to the previous listener's question, one would be that in my interactions with all of the people in law enforcement that I've come into contact with through the Opioid Council, as well as some regional coalitions like the Chittenden County Opioid Alliance, it's very clear to me that law enforcement is bending over backwards to try to direct people into treatment and to treat this as a public health condition and not as a public safety disorder. And I want people to really be aware of that. They are trying that. their hardest. Now, that doesn't mean that if somebody is doing some very high-level trafficking of drugs, they're not going to go to jail because they want to catch those people. But they don't want to take a person who is addicted to heroin and perhaps having a petty larceny to support their habit and put them into jail because they really know that that's a cry for help from that person.
So to put a fine point on that, you think that the education that law enforcement is getting and the way that law enforcement acts around Vermont, by and large, is helpful to this situation?
Absolutely. And the way that they have so courageously and successfully joined in all these efforts, they want to be at the table because they don't want to have these kind of outcomes. And unfortunately, law enforcement is a first responder. So many of them have actually had to see people either die or be resuscitated with naloxone. They feel this epidemic all the time and want to have help for these individuals. The other misconception I want to correct is that everyone using heroin is doing it because they feel so good. And sure, it does give people a high, needless to say. But when you really talk to people who are having a very sustained habit with heroin, the reason they are using their next dose of heroin is because they feel so horrible when they don't have heroin, because their body has been so sensitized to the medication that just a few hours without it and the cravings that develop are insurmountable, and the withdrawal symptoms that they begin to have. That's why medication-assisted treatment can be so successful for those that we can direct in that direction. And individuals then can have a very successful life because they don't deal with craving anymore. And even though they're not getting a high from the medication used to allay their craving, they're able to be productive in life.
We got a note from Rick Barnett, who's a psychologist, who says, "I applaud the work of the council. I urge us as a state to look beyond the hub-and-spoke model. Our mental health workforce is critical. Senate Bill 208 will improve access to mental health care by allowing doctors of psychology to prescribe or unprescribe psychiatric medications as long as they've achieved an MS in psychopharmacology and have a year of supervised practice." You know, we've talked about medication and the role of medication-assisted treatment in helping somebody who's addicted to opioids stop using heroin or, you know, pills. But beyond medication, beyond that hub and spoke, is there a lack of treatment options for people in their communities beyond the hub and spoke? So when we're talking about psychologists or support groups or other ways, and then that sort of leads us as well into other ways of supporting people who are coming out of addiction in terms of jobs and stigma and all the rest of the stuff that has to go along with somebody leading a successful life.
So I'll give you a high-level answer, and then I will hand this over to Commissioner Levine for a little bit more on the medical side. Some of the recommendations that the council made, including strengthening Vermont's recovery network, would provide wraparound supports, which we already do to a certain extent. We can enhance that. A job, a home, support groups, all critical to someone's recovery. And you begin recovery the first day you begin treatment. The focus on non-pharmacological forms of treatment and pain management is something that Governor Scott wrote about in a letter of recommendations to the NGA. The NGA has now stood that up, as has
the National Governors
National
Association.
Governors Association, as has the President's Commission, which focused on opioid use disorders. There's a lot of opportunity. UVM Medical Center is standing up an integrative healthcare pain management clinic, and insurers are looking at reimbursement for acupuncture, massage therapy, naturopathic medicine is already covered. So Vermont can lead the way with looking at these alternatives. It does not mean that initially it will replace medication-assisted treatment, and I think that's where I can hand this over to Commissioner Levine.
Medication-assisted treatment is a very strongly evidence-based management system, And so we do try to direct people that way, but we know that not everybody wants that. Some prefer not to take a drug every day. You mentioned faith-based organizations early on in the hour, and that's a possibility for those who wish to access that. It's just that most of the other systems don't have the track record, I think, of long-term success. But we certainly would never turn someone away from any kind of form of treatment that they thought might help them if they were actively engaged and had a support system around them.
We got a note from Matt in Windsor who says, folks are in denial about the root cause. Economic well-being will be the only thing that will fix this. The middle class has been falling behind for years. Fix that and drug use will drop. Is that true, Jolinda LeClaire? I mean, we're getting at some stereotypes here about who is addicted to opioids, but we also know that there is a correlation between poverty and drug use. So, you know, tease that out for us.
We do. And I think your question and comments are on spot. We have prevention coalitions. We have community-based, school-based across the state, which focus on poverty. And I go to the three P's because it's got to be a public, nonprofit, and private sector partnership in order for us to affect change. We need to make sure that the state has available jobs, that we have adequate housing supply. You can see statistically a correlation between people who are homeless and people who have substance use disorders. I think the state will, as the country, will always be on a path to try to improve people's well-being. It's a lifelong process.
Tom Dalton, Executive Director of Vermonters for Criminal Justice Reform, emailed in to say, our hub-and-spoke system is still failing at timely access to treatment. We still tolerate delays of days, weeks, and months in providing these life-saving medications. We need same-day access to buprenorphine and methadone. Dr. Levine, is that true? Still facing lots of delays?
I would disagree with that. We've had a small waiting list at our Rutland facility, which has pretty much evaporated due to improved connection of people at the hub with the spoke so that more slots would be opened. And everyone who was on that small waiting list had an action plan in place and had been contacted. I do think that it is important to have very early access to treatment. It doesn't have to be that moment, but there are some initiatives going on that will help that. There are pilots going on in several emergency departments so that if someone is brought in with an unintentional overdose and agrees to embark on therapy, they could get their first dose while in the emergency department, which I think is a big advance. That will hopefully start spreading throughout the state if it looks successful. But I think that it's a little bit of a misnomer to say that you can identify yourself as needing treatment and immediately get your first dose of anything. As I alluded to earlier, there's an intake process where we really try to match the person with the best form of treatment for them, and that requires some time. If you were seeing an oncologist for cancer, you wouldn't expect your first dose of chemotherapy that moment. You'd expect them to go through a staging evaluation and really diagnostic workup and help educate you as to what is available and what might be best for you.
Well, it's interesting to hear about and certainly, again, something we'll be hearing a lot more about and continuing to have a conversation about. Dr. Mark Levine is Vermont's health commissioner. Jolinda LeClaire is director of drug prevention policy for Vermont, and she oversees the state's Opioid Coordination Council. We have a link to the new report from that council at vpr.net. Jolinda LeClaire, Dr. Levine, thanks very much to both of you.
Thank you, Jane.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
This is Vermont Edition.